Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
It's time now for the Friday gathering, and I'm joined in the studio by Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal. Eamon Dunphy, presenter of The Stand podcast, is on the line, and Jack Chambers, Fianna Fáil Dublin West TD, is here too. You're very welcome. Thank you for being with us. Jack, I want to ask you, in the context of sport, which you have responsibility for as Minister of State, the head of the Polish Football Association said in a tweet a little earlier this morning, Poland are going to play their Euro 2020 matches in St. Petersburg and Seville. Now, two of their group games versus Slovakia and Sweden were supposed to be played here, weren't they, in the Aviva in June? We don't yet have official confirmation from UEFA, but that tweet would give us an indication of what's going to happen. Have we officially lost those games now?
We will this afternoon. It's a case of when, not if. I think obviously it's been well flagged in the last number of weeks that we weren't able to give the assurances of a quarter full stadia, so that would be 11,000, for example, in the Aviva.
That was so that's the, what they wanted. They wanted the stadium 25% full, and you just couldn't go there.
Well, no, we weren't able to, in the context of the current restrictions and predicting a number of weeks forward. Obviously, we are trying to reopen a lot of society, but being able to leapfrog into filling the having 11,000 people in one place and the and giving the assurances around that wasn't possible at this point.
Okay, so. And did you try, I mean, did you attempt and hope that it would be the case that you would be able to have these games go ahead in Ireland?
Oh, we'd always hoped. I mean, there's been a phenomenal amount of work from that over the last number of years and to put this in place, from Dublin City Council, my own department, Major Events Unit and the FAI. And obviously we're disappointed that this will happen. But I think we have to be honest about what's possible as well in the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Did you look at doing it, though, with antigen tests or PCR tests, or did you look at every option?
Well, look, we're in regular engagement with the Department of Health, and we're not in a position to get the assurance of a quarter full stadium. And mm-hmm. I think we have to respect the public health position around that. But just in terms of the broader piece on it, just I'd be confident that UEFA will use the Aviva in the future, and there's engagement between the FAI and UEFA on the broader piece on this. So
yeah, but I mean, we look at what Leinster Rugby are proposing in relation to antigen tests. Could we not have done that to save these games?
Well, I think there will be. So we've put a phenomenal amount of work, like from the autumn of last year, the FAI, the IRFU and the GEA have, with the Department of Sport and medical experts, we've a return to spectators plan. I think the Ferguson report and antigen testing will complement that. And I think we will have spectators back at games this summer. Mm-hmm. And we'll obviously have to run a number of pilot.
Not in June, obviously, because that's when these matches were scheduled for.
Yeah, well, like even if, say, you were to do one in June, for example, to do 11,000 in June as a starter event would be an extraordinary step up. So we will be doing test events in the summer. Obviously, we'll be able to give an indication close to time, but we will have, for example, League of Ireland games through the summer. We'll obviously have the All-Ireland series will be running as well. And I'd be hopeful. I think all of us here today and across the country would like to see go back to, you know, see a local game, see your local county, and there will be spectators and support. We give that signal to people. I think a lot of people.
And did we go back to the Euros and say, look, we can't do 11,000, but we could maybe try and do 4? Did you have? Do we have
minimum,
those conversations?
The minimum requirement
they wouldn't budge.
The minimum requirement from UEFA is a quarter full.
We'll bring Eamon Dunphy in on this. Good morning, Eamon. Thanks very much for being
morning,
with us.
Claire.
Are you disappointed to hear this news? Do you think we should have considered a safe way to get around this in order to have the fans in the stands?
No, I think the public health concerns should have been the principal that guided us, really, and it would have been nice to have the matches here. But it isn't safe. 11,000 people is a lot, and there's all the travelling to and from and after games. So there are all kinds of considerations that are more important in our present situation than some early round matches in the Euro. So I think the government is right not to yield on this. And unfortunately, we'll miss a few games, but it's better than... You know, that could be a super spreader And that's not wise.
Yeah, I mean, that's the risk, isn't it, Louise? That, you know, we try and keep them happy and have the games here, which we would all would have wanted to have the games here. It's disappointing that they're not coming. But as Eamon said, we could be looking at a terrible situation in the 2 weeks afterwards.
Yeah, no. Caution, I think, is wise. Caution should be the watchword. And I mean, as Jack has indicated there, there was engagement with UEFA, but they had a minimum requirement. And I think it's probably better at this stage to let people know. So, and it might be that when it comes to June, that we would be in a much better position. And, you know, there might be people sitting in this chair in a couple of weeks' time saying, oh, we should have done it. Look where we are now. But look, it's better, I think, to be safe than sorry. It could, as Eamon quite rightly points out there, it could turn into a super spread event. Nobody wants to see that. Having said that, we all want to see sport back. I wouldn't be a massive soccer fan, but I do very much look forward to being able to see the Dubs at some point, you know, or even just to go down and have a look at Harps in my own area. I think people are missing sport. They're missing that kind of the closeness, and they're missing the excitement, the fun, the build up, all of that. I mean, Dublin won the All-Ireland last year. Myself and my husband, we'd normally be on the hill. We were sitting in the living room. Now, I mean, it was still brilliant. Obviously, we're all Ireland champions. We're not going to hand that back. But it, nothing beats being there. I mean, that, like, you know, we all say that when you're at the game, nothing beats being there, yeah. Being on the hill, the sense of camaraderie, the you know, and all of that involves crowds, and crowds just can't happen at the moment. It's a very it's unfortunate, but I think an abundance of caution is the phrase du jour, and that's what they're doing.
Eamon, I want to talk to you about the other big story from the start of the week, the European Super League. I mean, I still can't believe it happened. It was just extraordinary. No.
Yeah, it was a very stupid plan anyway, and they had no details. They announced it in a press release at 12 o'clock on Sunday night at midnight. They are greedy. They were being greedy. They executed it stupidly. It had no merit at all, but it would have done enormous damage. The Champions League would have been finished. The Premier League would have been damaged, and all the European domestic leagues. It was driven really by Americans. They were the ones. There were three American owners, Manchester United's owners, Liverpool's owners, and Arsenal, who saw a chance to really create franchises, which is what American football has, and also baseball. And it actually means, in the end, you could move Liverpool to Birmingham if you chose. They had no idea what they were dealing with in terms of tradition and the feelings of the fans. And there was a big fight back by fans, by players and pundits on British television, by the media in England. And it was the English clubs that...
And some managers as well. And listen, when you talk about moving clubs, I saw Fiona Looney was writing about this in the Mail on Wednesday, about your own plans, the Dublin Dons idea in the 1990s. Yeah. I mean, that was... Will you explain to us what the plan was there, the team that nearly was?
Well, the plan was Wimbledon didn't belong where they were situated in South London. And they were getting very small gates, 5,000 to 10,000 in the Premier League. So they wanted a home. And Wimbledon wasn't their home. They were renting there. And I thought, and others, that Dublin could support a Premier League team, 50,000, 60,000 people. There was a site with planning permission at Neilstown, and that's what we tried to do for the benefit of Irish football fans and Irish footballers, because so far, if you want to play soccer professionally, you've got to emigrate. So that was a different idea altogether. It was nothing like this.
Yeah, but the same thing, the way you described the American sports franchises moving the clubs to other cities, the idea here was to uproot this club and bring it to Dublin.
It was a club without real, with only about 5,000 fans playing in the Premier League. It couldn't survive, and it hasn't survived. They're down two or three divisions now. Mm-hmm. So it was preserving it. It wasn't moving something like Liverpool Football Club or Manchester United. It was preserving Liverpool at Wimbledon, and they're now not preserved.
Yeah, I suppose both examples, though, show the power of fans, really, and public opinion, don't they?
Yeah, the people in England have been brilliant. The fans have been brilliant. The players have been, and the coaches. And even Boris Johnson got this one right.
Yeah, so, although I mean, the question's about his meeting now.
I'm not a fan of Boris Johnson, but he threatened to legislate. Yeah. The problem for the European clubs, the Spanish and Italian clubs, is they've no money. They're broke.
Yeah.
They've been profligate. Yeah.
And the reaction over in Spain was quite different, wasn't it?
Totally muted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a podcast with an Irish journalist in Spain. Nobody protested. People just accepted it.
Okay. But I want to bring Jack Chambers in on this because you hated this idea as well, right?
I did. I think anyone, I said, growing up playing football myself and as someone who, you know, supports the grassroots here and you know, we all want to see sport being a community-based activity, and I think this was everything that sport shouldn't be about, an elitist closed shop, clubs segregating off purely for profit, as Eamon said, and I agree with him. And I think it was rejected by fans, by players, by across the board. And mm-hmm. I think the outcome demonstrates the opposition to it.
Will it rear its head again? You know, if, as Eamon says, there's a big problem in mainland Europe with cash for these clubs, will it come back to us again?
Well, I think, you know, UEFA has to maintain the integrity of its pyramidal system in terms of the cross nations, big and small, and how football works. Obviously, certain clubs have overstretched themselves financially and with their with the transfer market and their exposure with wages. And inevitably, they'll have to repurpose their own balance sheets when it comes to how exposed they are. But I think where you've got strong football clubs at whatever level that are supported by fans, clubs can be sustained. And if you look at particularly fan clubs that are owned by fans in Germany and elsewhere, you see the power of that kind of democratic route in clubs, and that's something I support. And I suppose from an Irish perspective, in our engagement with the FAI and elsewhere, we want to support our own league and invest in our league in terms of the stadia there so that we can strengthen the League of Ireland as well in the Irish context.
Louise?
I think I'm reliably informed now that we don't need the Super League, because in fact there's a Super League match tonight. Bows are playing Rovers. That's as much excitement as any Irish soccer fan is going to need. But look, let's not lose sight of the fact that, like, these football clubs were built by working class men and women, the fans, the people on the terraces. And, you know, just the same as I think, you know, to be fair, Eamon, it would have been wrong to ignore the legacy fans in London and move a team here. It was also wrong when you hear people say, you know, using phrases like the legacy fans. The legacy fans are the ones that built the clubs up from nothing. They built the clubs up from the ground. They're loyal. They're loyal fans. They're the people who look forward to being on the terraces every single week. But, you know, we need to look at the league here at our own, you know, at the League of Ireland clubs, at clubs like Bowes and Rovers and Derry City. And I know the documentary that was on recently in relation to Derry City Football Club, it just showed the tremendous power of sport to unite communities, to transcend everything else and simply bring people out just to have a really good time, to follow their team, the highs and lows, and all that go along with it.
At the upper echelons of football, that it's not all about money. It is all about
this was
money.
About greed, pure and simple. That's exactly
what
it was.
But even without this idea.
And, you know, to be honest with you, when I see that, and as I'm not a soccer fan, don't follow any club at all, married to a Liverpool supporter, and also, you know, he follows Preston North End, I'm reliably informed. So, you know, we need to look at how we can build and sustain our own league. Yes, there is absolute greed. It was greed that was driving this. There was no reason for it. It was greed and TV rights and all the rest of it that was driving this. And I think there needs to be a return to the fan base, you know, to the people who are, and like, I mean, Jack will know this as well, people who are out, you know, with the League of Ireland, who go on the road to follow their team when they can, who go on the road to follow their team, the working class men and women who built the clubs, you know, from nothing, who were the fans, and to say and to read people, you know, the idea that they were
going
to divide the fans into legacy
fans and
new fans. I'm not sure, Eamon. I thought that was just awful.
I'm not sure, Eamon, if this will prompt something like that to happen, for there to be a big movement now to take this back down to a level that brings it back to grassroots and in any way take the big money out of the game. That's not going to happen.
Well, one key reform that would help, Bayern Munich refused to, and they are the German champions and one of the most famous clubs in the world, they refused to participate in this. Bayern Munich and Dortmund, they have a system in Bayern. The fans have the final say. It's 50% plus one you need to pass any change. And Barcelona also observe this. So there is a way, and I think it is the way all clubs should be reformed, that fans should have a vote and that nobody can act unilaterally. Yeah. No billionaire can come in from the Middle East or from the United States and take power. I think the best way to ensure the fans have the power is to replicate the Bayern Munich
The model. Yeah. Okay. I want to move on to the story about Sinn Féin and the database of voters, what it was used for, where it was stored, what info was on it. This has been going on now for close on 2 weeks, and Mary Lou MacDonald on Primetime last night admitted the two areas where the party was not in compliance with data protection laws, which we'll get into in a minute. Eamon, can I come to you first on this? The Irish Independent, Philip Ryan in particular, they've been reporting on this in great detail. How do you think the party has dealt with it, first of all?
Well, they appear to have been sort of reluctant to give information, for example, to say where this database was stored. It turns out it's Frankfurt. And the only question I would ask is how familiar they are with the rules and how familiar. Apparently there's 3.5 million people on in the system. The question I'd ask Louise is, can I find out what's on the system about me?
Well, I can tell you, any political party.
Just hold
on for there a second. Any political party that manages in the 3 weeks of an election campaign to canvass 3.5 million people, I have to say they'd get my vote because I don't know how they would do it. In truth, and I mean, Jack will be aware of this, and anyone who's been involved in any electoral campaign and will know, you get to a very small number of doors. The 3.5 million refers to the number of people who are on the electoral register. But of course, I mean, much and all, as and I know Jack won't disagree with me on this, much and all as we would love to be able to canvass 3.5 million people in 3 weeks, that's not going to happen. You simply physically couldn't, you wouldn't be able to do that. Mm.
But has it been explained to you, or do you know why you would need to store a database with information about voters in London, like, and then move it to Frankfurt? Why are we doing that?
So it was stored at all times within the European Union. It's not a suitcase full of documents or a physical file. It's just where the websites are hosted. And in anticipation of Brexit, my understanding is that it was moved from London to Frankfurt. But if you look on any website where there's hosting, you'll normally see a little message. I saw it on some TDs have it on their websites as well. A message will say that the information is stored within the European Union in full compliance of data protection law, because the data protection law is EU law. You know, and like, let's be very clear. Data is important. Security is important. I mean, that's why we.
But you had no data protection officer until yesterday.
We had a data compliance officer,
and no data protection impact assessment done either.
And the data protection impact assessment is a matter of good practice, and that has been done now. And as I say, we engaged with the data protection commissioner when we were advised that it would be best practice to upgrade from a data compliance officer to a data protection officer. That was done, and it was done immediately because we're all learning. We want to get it right. That's why we have engaged with the data protection commissioner. That's why we've sent on all of the information that was requested and answered all of the questions. And as has been said by my colleagues and others, you know, we are confident that we're fully compliant, but we are in a process with the data protection commissioner. So, you know, there has been an exchange of correspondence now.
And do you expect that the other political parties are doing similar, if not the same, as you've been accused of doing?
Well, I don't think we've been accused of doing anything, but I mean, all parties have their own methods of recording their canvas-related data. So some hold it centrally. Personally, I think holding it centrally is a good idea because it means you can have a tight hold of the security on it. Others hold it at the level of the constituency. And I think all political parties value that engagement. I was actually listening to a little bit of Eamon's podcast there recently with Fionnuala Sheehan, and he made the point that, you know, Tony Gregory would not have been able to get elected were it not for the fact fact that that he knew where his vote was. All political parties want, you want to know where your vote is, but importantly as well, and during an election, you don't want to be calling to the same two doors in a housing estate every week. You want to know that you've called to someone, you didn't get an answer, so you can call back. You want to do the maximum amount of engagement because one, that's what gets you votes, but two, that's also what gets you, you know, the quality of that engagement and the, you know, the fact that you can put yourself in front of the voters as you do when you're in politics and you can have those conversations.
All right, Jack Chambers, do all political parties not have these types of canvassing tools?
Well, I think your reporter on Primetime yesterday answered that question, and it was very clear that this is a unique database that Sinn Féin have. And I think what people were listening will be, what I would be concerned about this is that for me, it is this the an Irish version of what happened with Cambridge Analytica?
It's not. I put that fair to bed for you, so it's not.
And that I think, you know, is the foundations of something similar in Ireland?
It's
and
not.
And the reason, no, the reason I'd say, like, you have 3.5 million piece of people centrally controlled. I suppose the questions I would have is, who has access to those people? Like, do people in your constituency, Louise, is there someone outside of your constituency can access that? And also, who funds this? And separate to that as well, the fact, like, are people's Facebook profiles, most people listening may have a Facebook profile, a social media profile, are you unknown to them taking information and aligning that?
No, we're not. No, I'm really happy to be able to answer that.
And why was that in your in the documentation that was produced? Why are you telling activists to do that?
What you're referring to is a handbook that refers to people who, you know, engaging with voters where they're at and using Facebook as a communication tool. But Facebook is a very, very important communication tool. We don't mine data. And look, you know, we are engaging with the Data Protection Commissioner because I think that it's important that we do that. The questions, we've been asked a series of questions and asked to provide information. That's gone to the Data Protection Commissioner now.
Who funds this database?
So the database is funded by the party, but I mean, it's what it is.
Why are you asking that question? What do you think is going on? I just want to know why he's asking that question.
I'm asking that question because is it funded from the Southern arm? Is it funded from the Northern arm? Is it funded from an international arm?
Do you think that's why the database is not being held in Ireland?
I think that's a legitimate question that the party of Sinn Féin need to answer, number one. And number two, they need to answer it, who has access to it? And because what we have here is data centrally stored and controlled outside of this country, and it's not clear who has access to the information of your constituency in Dublin, for example, in the same way as
the information that is kept locally by many of your own colleagues. It would be the candidate and their agents. So I mean, that's and it is the electoral register that is used. The electoral register, the names and addresses of people, and obviously people can opt out of having their name on the public version of the electoral register should they choose to do that. But it's hosted within the European Union because the GDPR and the other laws that we are required to comply with, and we do comply with, are European laws. So it is important to us that it is stored within the European Union. And more importantly, that's why we engage and we use an internationally respected company, because this stuff is complicated, because we need to be sure that we get it right. In fairness, you've done
engagement and surveys with, say, third level students on rent on a whole variety of topics through Facebook. You've asked them for their information.
And that informs our policy, Jack, and that's all it does.
And were any of those surveys transposed onto that central database? No, they weren't.
Those surveys, and we engage in them very, very regularly. And it's one of the things, and look at, you know, I think we're all missing the opportunity to be on the doors and have that engagement and be out, you know, but it's still important for us as politicians that we don't disappear and that we do engage with our voters and that we do engage with our constituents. But that doesn't mean you can go as far as if
what you're doing was taking data from Facebook,
but we're not
cross-referencing it with the electoral register and giving people a tick.
I think for the fifth time, we're not doing that. What we do when we engage in surveys is we go out and we talk to people as directly as we can, because it's important to us that we have that communication and we want to hear from them.
But you may not know, though, whether you were doing that or not, because you didn't have the impact assessment done. So you may not know whether you were doing that or not.
The data protection impact assessment has been done now, and it's gone to the Data Protection Commissioner. And as I said, you know, it was suggested to us that we should do it. I'm not certain that other political parties have done it. I don't know. I think if you're holding information,
do you know what? That's a good point. When I was reading about this story and I saw it over the last couple of days, I was thinking to myself, I'd say all the other parties now are frantically looking at what they do to make sure that they're compliant as well. Jack, is that been going on?
We have a data protection officer and someone who's trained and like that. And Louise said earlier that, you know, they're fully compliant. I think we know from Mary Lou McDonald's contribution in Primetime last night that she admitted that the party wasn't compliant with data protection.
Well, we're compliant,
laws.
As I said.
You've said you're compliant, but you've also said you're not compliant.
No, just let me finish now, because it's not we were told as a matter of best practice that we should upgrade our data compliance officer to a data protection officer. At the moment that was suggested to us, that was done, because it's a matter
of
best practice.
Will you give access to any constituent, anyone who's listening to this program, will you have access to any of the information?
So at the moment, Jack, as you know, we're engaged in a process with the Data Protection Commissioner. We have given over all of the information that was requested. That engagement is ongoing. We absolutely need to do that. But when it comes to the data protection impact assessment, I'm not certain that all political parties have done it. We've been advised that it's a matter of best practice, but I would like to see all political parties.
Has Fianna Fáil done it?
I think we have a data protection officer and we're
in compliance. You would expect the impact assessment is done. Okay, let's talk a little bit about COVID and what's been happening over the course of the last few days. We had politicians raising the prospect of foreign holidays before the end of the summer. Were they right to do that, Jack?
Well, look, I think, you know, we are engaged in a process with the EU, as you know.
Thomas Byrne was telling me all about it yesterday, and I was saying to him, it sounds messy. He said the whole thing is messy. But, you know, is it right to say to people, you might be getting on a plane in August when we're at this stage, in early stage in the vaccination?
I think we can't give a definitive timeline about when, but I think it's positive that we're in a process with the EU, which will, underpinned by science, enable travel within the EU. And I think a lot of people listening to your programme may not have seen their loved one or family or friend for many months or even years. And I think
that's why it's dangerous to hold out that prospect when it may not happen.
I don't think we can give timelines to people, but there is a process in the EU that's moving properly and formally. And it will have to be obviously underpinned by science and mitigation. And that's what they're going through presently. But I'd be hopeful it could be, I said, late summer, early autumn. I'm not going to give a timeline because I don't want to give a specific date to people. But I think, with vaccination, with suppression of the virus, with a process that's underpinned by science, and that's what we're trying to do across the EU, and I think it's positive Ireland is involved in it, that we can give people that hope during the year that they can see their loved one or they can visit a family or friend. And that's something that people have been deprived of for 12 months.
Eamon, would you be happy to get on a plane?
No, I wouldn't be wishing to go on holiday this year. I think we've got to be very careful. The government can make decisions driven by data rather than, an urge or an impulse. There's some lessons. India, for example, declared victory over the virus 2 months ago, and now it's the worst human catastrophe imaginable in the world. They have no room in hospitals. They have no oxygen. So we have to learn to be to a bit of humility. We can't be making promises about going on holiday further down the road because we don't know if it's going to be safe.
Stephen Donnelly yesterday in the Dáil saying that Ireland was taking part in this EU-initiated legal case against AstraZeneca, and then the EU comes out and says there's no decision yet. Well, what was he at? Do you know what? I started the week saying what was Stephen Donnelly at about saying that under 30s, 18 to 30s would be vaccinated before other cohorts, and I'm ending the week saying what's Stephen Donnelly at?
Well, look, to be fair, I also saw a lot of his contribution on a lot of the positives that are happening with the vaccination rollout. 95% of over 70s will have received their first vaccine. Many people at home now from being 60
and
69 will be able to register.
I'm sure they would say they're doing a great job on that. But why is he claiming we're part of a legal case that hasn't been started yet?
I'm not across the fact of whether a legal case is or isn't being taken or not.
But neither is the Minister for Health, and I think that's the problem, Jack.
To be fair,
just let me finish. Commission, okay, yeah, that he indicated that that this process was underway. That was then contradicted by Ó Tánaiste on the radio. And I think that kind of mixed messaging really it worries people and it annoys them. And I share something with you now. Before I left my office in Leinster House to come here, I spoke to a woman who runs a domestic abuse shelter. And there's 25 people on her staff. Five of them have been vaccinated. They registered for the portal in the portal 9 weeks ago. The portal is now closed. They have no idea when the other 20 are going to be vaccinated. They are currently dealing with two families who are self-isolating because they're close contacts. These people are frontline workers. So it really, really, really annoys them when they hear your Minister for Health, your Ó Tánaiste and your Taoiseach say things like, we've vaccinated all healthcare workers. Likewise, I have a home help working in my own area. She registered in the portal over 2 months ago. She still hasn't been given a date. So what we need to do is we need realistic information to be shared with people. And we also need the capacity to be able to say, we missed those 20 people. We got it wrong. Let's go back and fix that. Those women need and men who are working
in DT shelters. Do you want to say something there before we finish?
Need to have this vaccine.
Not really. The only thing I would say is that I can testify from the experience of a family member, the test and trace is not working, and the situation in some schools is very dangerous, and it's much too early to be declaring victory or even optimism. We just have to be cautious with this virus.
Yeah. We can't have any more kite flying. It's driving people up the wall.
We've got to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Louise O'Reilly, Jack Chambers and Eamon Dunphy.